Hello and welcome to the July edition of Tech IEEE, the radio show put on by the New Hampshire section of the IEEE. The IEEE, also known as the Institute of Electronics and Electrical Engineers, is a worldwide organization of engineers working in all disciplines. IEEE, advancing humanity through technology. My name is Ed Nelson. I'll be your host tonight. I am the chair of the New Hampshire section of the IEEE. In the past couple of years, I've served as the vice chair of the New Hampshire section. And before that, I served as the chair and vice chair of the New Hampshire section of the Computer Society. So for today's topics, for the first segment, we're going to talk about the Dover Mini Maker Faire and the maker movement in New Hampshire. Joining us in the studio will be Rich Maynard, and we'll have a special guest, Jane Bard, calling in from the Children's Museum in Dover. For the second segment, our topic will be card skimming, and our special guest joining us over the phone will be Neeraj Gupta of Vantiv. Joining me tonight, I've got Anton Kaska, Mike Saffel, and Rich Maynard. So, Anton, it's great to have you back. Could you please say a few words about yourself?
Sure, Ed. It's good to be back. My name's Anton, and I'm the current chair of P1915, which is a working group for security in virtualized environments, which is the way computing is going. And so our work is security-oriented and wrapped around future technology, like many of the IEEE efforts.
Tonight also, we've got Mike Saffel, who's joining us again. Mike, how you doing tonight?
Doing good. Doing good.
Say a few words, introduce yourself, if you would.
Yeah, I'm Michael Saffel. I'm a lifelong broadcast engineer, a member of the Broadcast Technology Society and the Computer Society.
And joining us for the first time this month is Rich Maynard. Welcome, Rich.
Hey, thanks. Yeah, I'm the chair of the Robotics and Automation Society for the IEEE. But what more importantly for this is I'm also one of the core members for the Makers of Manchester. And if all goes well, we'll be presenting some of our projects at the Maker Faire, which Jane will talk about in a little bit.
And joining us on the line, we've got a special guest, Jane Bard, the director of the Children's Museum located in Dover, New Hampshire. Welcome, Jane.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
So could you tell us a little bit about yourself and about the Maker event that's happening at the Children's Museum?
Yes. Well, as you mentioned, I'm the director of the Children's Museum of New Hampshire. That's one role, but the role I'm here representing tonight is we're the organization that hosts the Dover Mini Maker Faire. It's our fourth annual fair coming up this August 27th. And for those of you who aren't familiar with Maker Faires in general, there's something that started in the Silicon Valley of California about a decade ago when people realized that, you know, you've heard of craft fairs, you've heard of other gatherings for people who make things, but Maker Faire is really celebrating ingenuity, invention, creativity, tinkering, and making of all kinds. For people who love to watch how things are made and understand the why and the how and meet people who are doing amazing things, that's what Maker Faire is all about. So, we're excited to be hosting that event again, and as Rich just mentioned, he's part of one of the groups that come to Maker Faire.
That sounds like a great event. I can't wait to go again this year. Full disclosure, I was there last year. I really enjoyed it.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, people, especially, you know, we're here in New Hampshire, in New England, we're all about Yankee ingenuity and tinkering in our garages and figuring out the way things work. And so it's a great all ages celebration, bringing together people who make things for a living, people, you know, we're here with the IEEE. So people who choose this as a profession, as a hobby, people who are studying engineering and sciences in college, to student groups doing robotics, to making of music and making of food and making of artisanal products. So Maker Faire is really bringing all of those people together and giving them also the chance to connect with each other in one great venue and day. So yes, that's why I'm here tonight.
No, great. It's great to have you. Yeah, when you talk about tinkering and people making things, I can't help but think about my grandfather who went to the dump and bought a lawnmower there for like $2 and brought it home and got it working again. Back in when I was a kid, we didn't call that being a maker. We called that just being cheap.
Exactly. Or it's really being creative and resourceful with whatever you have around you. So, yeah, some of my favorite makers at Maker Faire are people who take, you know, last year we had actually two teenage boys who repurposed a jukebox. You know, we have people who are making kayaks. We have people who are making robots. Or a musical toaster is another great, great making thing that I've seen at the Maker Faire. So, you know, it takes on making itself and Maker Faires. They take on many different aspects, and there are many ways that people can be makers and recognize the maker within themselves.
Yeah.
That's great.
Great. I heard you say robots.
Yes. Yes.
I wonder if anybody in this room is a maker with a robot.
So Ed's making faces at me, and that's probably because I have brought some in the context of the Makers of Manchester. We'll be bringing some more this year, and actually I'm not quite sure. I've been involved in literally three different groups which will potentially be there this year. So not only is we're going there as the IEEE, I've got all my paperwork. We've got all our paperwork. We're good to go.
Good.
The Makers in Manchester group I was going to sign up for, but we'll have to see how that goes. I'm not generally the leader for that organization, but I know that she was interested in doing it again this year. And what we may actually have is a tailgater from the Nashua Robot Builders Club. We'll be talking this Sunday about whether or not they want to go as a separate group or if they want to tag along with the Robots and Automation Society and the IEEE in general. So by hook or by crook, there will probably be at least two other groups I'll be associated with at the fair. And robots will be prevalent for all of them, essentially.
That'll be awesome.
Yeah, that's great.
So, Jane, is the Children's Museum of New Hampshire somehow involved in organizing the Maker events or the Maker happenings in New Hampshire?
Yes. Well, Maker Faire is obviously our flagship event that we host and plan. But then we work with other maker groups like the Makers in Manchester, Port City Maker Space, student groups at UNH, the Portsmouth Naval Shipyard. So the wonderful thing about Maker Faire is it's introduced us to so many groups that are doing great things in New Hampshire, and we can piggyback on that and host other events throughout the year. And this year, something very exciting at the museum itself that grew out of Maker Faire is that we opened up a new space called the STEAM Innovation Lab. And so STEAM, a lot of people know STEM is, you know, science, technology, engineering, and math. And so our STEAM lab just has the arts infused because, you know, a lot of even robots can be beautiful, right? They're not just about the electronics, but they're also about the design of the robot and the function of the robot. So, yeah, we have a new space for students, teachers, and we kind of consider it like a prototype classroom of tomorrow. So we have a 3D printer. We have other technology. We have high-tech microscopes that you can look at DNA with. And we have lots and lots of making types of materials available. So students can come in and be introduced to making at a very early age.
That's great. What's the recommended, or is there an age range of people you'd like to see using the STEAM space?
Well, we actually host school groups as young as kindergarten through middle school. But we also host free family programming every day. And we have even adult child workshops that happen in the lab. So it can be for anyone who'd like to visit the museum. And we host camps in there as well. We did our first Create Your Own Video Game Camp over February vacation, where children ages 8 to 12 were actually learning JavaScript and creating their own video games.
That's impressive.
That was really exciting. Yeah. So yes, and you know, we just opened that this year, so we'll be continuing to grow from there. And You know, that's what's wonderful about making and makers in New Hampshire is it's a great community. And when people see something like that, and like Maker Faire, you know, they want to be involved and, you know, in raising this new generation of creative thinkers and innovators. So that's our role and our part, our small part in what's happening in New Hampshire right now with the maker movement.
Yeah, I was lucky enough to go down to see the makerspace in Nashua, and they had a lot of really cool equipment in there. I remember seeing a laser etcher, a CNC machine. I guess I'm wondering, I would think that one of the great things about being part of one of these maker spaces or being a member of one of these maker organizations is that you would have access to these machines so that you could work on some of your projects that would otherwise just be really hard to do because you'd have no way to get the tools you need to get them done.
Right. And just to give them a little plug, the one you're talking about is Make It Labs, which is in Nashua. I don't know if you've seen their space recently. They've moved to a new building. They have a much larger facility at this point and a few more tools. But they have a growing membership. They have people coming in, making use of their space. And it does. It provides people who don't have, you know, a basement or a garage or the necessary tools to do their projects. They have, you know, soldering, programming, machining, woodworking. I think the only thing they don't have that I haven't seen is something like glass blowing, you know, but you don't see that too often.
Right.
But they do have a fairly large facility that allows you to do quite a few things.
Mm-hmm. They've worked through, like you said, it's a relatively new. I was there for the re-grand opening, I guess.
Yeah.
They had worked through, you know, difficulties at the first facility they were in
right
there, and then just moved a little ways away and to
it's around the corner, as a matter
exactly
of fact,
yeah in a very nice facility now.
Sure.
Yeah.
And now we have there's a new space that's opened up in the Manchester area, so I should distinguish there is the Makers in Manchester, and we're actually associated with the Sea Museum over here in Manchester, and we're essentially more of a social group. Most of us, I guess, would be considered super makers in that we have our own tools. We have a garage. We have a basement. We have a lot of stuff that allows us to do our projects at home. But we have new people coming in all the time who are interested in getting involved. And now there is the Manchester Makerspace, which is similar to Make It Labs. It's a smaller facility, but they're growing. They've also opened up recently. I think maybe 2 months ago is where they first opened up.
Yep.
And so we'll have something local as well. Well, local, I mean in Manchester.
In Manchester, yeah.
And to me, I think that's what's really exciting about maker spaces or maker groups like you're discussing is, you know, people to have a place to actually talk about projects and get other people's advice. I know that that's something exciting that I hear from, you know, Port City Makerspace is it's not just the tools, it's the camaraderie, it's the problem solving, it's exactly. I'm working on my project here, you know, do you have any thoughts on how I can change it, or the classes that they provide to, you know, help people be more proficient and comfortable with different tools or understanding how to use them in different ways. Because a lot of schools now, you know, we don't really have, I know in my local school, we don't have shop classes anymore, right? We don't have intro to electronics for high school kids in my town. And having places in the community and groups where you can go to have those discussions or learn those skills or be introduced to those tools, I think it's just really important.
And that's go ahead, Anton.
Go ahead.
You know, it's interesting, too, because I think one of the things that Ed said was, you know, those kind of spaces are places where you could never, well, other than what Rich said, there's super users, you know, that have, you know, majority of, you know, some of these things at home. But for a lot of people, it's hard to amass, you know, that kind of, you know, infrastructure or inventory and have the space for it, that kind of thing. So you're sharing, you know, physical tools and workspace and things like that. But there's, Jane, like you said, there's also sort of that social and personal or, I guess, interpersonal kind of interactions that also bring another aspect to things, just like there's multiple tools, you know, that you've got multiple viewpoints, multiple, you know, experiences and things like that that can be brought to bear on a project.
Well, let me give you an example. At one of the last meetings or a couple of meetings ago, I was commenting on a musician, one of the musicians in our group, who actually builds musical instruments out of, he was building musical instruments out of old propane tanks. And I said, you know, that'd be kind of interesting to put together, I guess we'd call it a gamelan. It's kind of a bell type of instrument. And I was suggesting, you know, it'd be interesting to put together an automated version of that. I've seen one of those things at the New York Maker Faire last year. And so we got to talking, and he essentially built me up a one of the bells in there. And he said, okay, throw the solenoids on it. That's your job. And I said, great, this is going to be an opportunity. I don't know if we'll have it ready for this, for the Dover Maker Faire, but this is certainly something we'd like to show off. And it's kind of interesting to see these things play.
Jane, this is Anton. So I'm familiar with makers, the terminology and the people and the idea of making. I'm not familiar with these events and these dedicated spaces, so I'm kind of an outsider. I'm also a homeschooling parent, and so I've got a couple of questions also for our viewer or our listeners. One, could you repeat the dates of the Maker Faire for us and our listeners? And also, do you see much attendance at this Maker Faire from the homeschooling community? Because I know a lot of times, sometimes they're left out of things, and sometimes they're the only ones participating in cool things. It's kind of a hit and miss, depending on, I think, probably which parents are involved with the different ideas. As homeschoolers, we get a lot of bennies, if you will, at museums and things like that, and dedicated times, which is great. But I'm not familiar with this, and I know the communities that my wife and I are involved with. I haven't seen anything about this on those, and so that's kind of an interest to me. As I understand it from tonight's discussions, the demonstrators, if you will, the makers, are a range of people. It could be young kids. It could be older people. It could be whomever. But I was wondering more, who's the audience? Who attends and who gets out there? It's in summer, so school's out, so it's a good time.
Yep. School is out, so it is, once again, it's on Saturday, August 27th, which is the Saturday before Labor Day weekend. It's from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., it's at the Children's Museum of New Hampshire, which is in Dover, New Hampshire, but it's not just within the museum. We actually take over the outside park area and some adjacent mill building space as well. And our audience is typically about 1,200 to 1,600 attendees, and that doesn't include the 50 to 60 makers and their maker groups. So, for example, you know, one group might have 10 people in, you know, 10 makers, depending on the size of that group. And then we also have many volunteers to run the event. And interestingly enough, we have the audience is primarily 70% of attendees are adults, believe it or not, and 30% children, which is because it's hosted by the Children's Museum. It's interesting that we get a lot of adults, but I think adults are more aware of the Maker Faire concept. And there are a lot of Maker Faire groupies that will travel from Maker Faire to Maker Faire and visit several of them within a season. So we get a lot of those people attending. As far as the homeschool audience is concerned, we do have a lot of members of the museum who are homeschool families, and they tend to know about it and attend Maker Faire. But it is, I think the name Maker Faire, if you don't know what it is, and the word fair sometimes just connotes like, oh, a craft fair. So they don't really understand, you know, it's taking us a lot of time to really build that recognition and understanding that the Maker Faire is not just come and look. It's a lot of come and do and come
passive,
and talk to people.
Right, it's not a passive
right.
event. Yeah.
Well, I'm one of the people in the Communication Society at IEEE, so I may work with you offline a little bit on that. I have some ideas already that we might get the word out. Am I correct to assume that you'd like to see more youth involved?
Oh, definitely. We would definitely like to see more youth involved as makers and as attendees. You know, it's interesting. One of our makers, his name is Corky, And he comes to some very interesting projects every year. And the first year, his wife came with him and said, I don't think this Maker Faire, you know, is really for me. I'll just come and help you set up and I'm going to leave. And then he thought she left for the day and she came back at the end of Maker Faire. And he said, what are you doing here? And she said, oh, I've actually been here all day visiting all the makers.
That's great.
Which was a wonderful testament and, you know, a fact that we're really excited and proud of. So Maker Faire really is for all ages, but we would love to have more children involved.
And it's one thing to answer you, Anton, as far as the demographics of it. I mean, a substantial part of it are other makers that are coming to the fair. But I should point out that's a fairly broad definition. I mean, Maker itself represents just about any kind of hobby you can think of. You know, it's not always just, I mean, we talk about, a lot of people think about robotics and Arduino and 3D printers, but there are people who come in and do things like cosplay or costuming. There are people who come in, like Jane says, they do cooking, specialized pastries, you know, that kind of stuff. There are groups that come in that do trebuchets, you know, they actually launch these things in the back, you know. And there's some folks in there that do like bicycle projects. They will build bicycles on extended stilts, you know, you'd be riding a bike like 8 feet in the air, that kind of thing. I don't know if you've seen that over at Dover, but I have seen those kinds of things at New York, for instance.
Yeah, that's interesting. We my son and I build atlatls, actually, and nothing like a little short 11-year-old throwing an 11-foot spear 50 yards.
Welcome to the Maker Clan, you know.
Exactly. Well, that's the great thing, too, is Maker Faire, there are booths set up, but there are also performances and demonstrations and workshops. So you can do many things at the fair. And if you have something that might not fit, you know, being in a booth all day, but it's something that could be demonstrated at a certain time during the fair, that we welcome all of those people to participate in the fair. And anyone who'd like to be a maker, the call for makers is open until August 5th. So it's a simple online Google Doc that people who visit the website for the event, which is www.makerfaire, and fair has an E like the Renaissance Fair, makerfairedover.com. You can find lots of information about the fair, but you can also sign up to be a maker.
That's great. Mike, you said you had some experience of taking your kids down to a maker something in.
Yeah, there's a place called Creation Station in Westford, Massachusetts. It's got sort of the adult side of the maker space, the traditional, you know, you see a lot with the laser cutters and 3D printers and solder stations and the whole thing. But they also have a bit of an extensive part of space that's more open and is geared towards younger kids. There's the Sphero and the Lego Mindstorms and the Little Bits and a few different systems that I don't even remember. And again, it's being able to get some exposure with a variety of systems and things to build with. And at that place, they offer a sort of drop-in option where you can come and just spend a few hours for a small charge and take advantage of the space or you can be a member and you know have more consistent access, but that kind of thing is interesting in that whole idea of getting kids whatever aspect of Maker the Maker environment that they're interested in, you know, just getting them involved and saying, yeah, you can work in there and have some options and have a palette to sort of experiment with or get used to, you know, a variety of things to use and build with.
Yeah, that sounds really cool. Which there's a question in my mind, and maybe Rich, you're the best one to ask this, or maybe Jane, you know. How hard is it to become a member of one of the local maker groups?
Well, if you're going to become a member of a makerspace, generally there's a fee. And like, for instance, Make It Labs gives you an orientation, and I think they have one every Thursday night, I believe. Or they have it at least once a week. if you're going to become a member of Makers of Manchester, is pretty much just show up on Thursdays, the third Thursday of the month. So it's not very difficult at all. Probably the most difficult part about it that I've complained about is finding a parking space. Manchester.
Down in the mills, right?
Right, right. Yeah. So, but other than that, it's like, you know, hey, come on in, talk about what you're interested in, and show it off, and, you know, we talk about it.
Right. And I was going to say, I know with Port City Makerspace, for example, you know, I think of it like that's a like a gym membership. You know, it's a monthly membership fee, but that's your gym. It's a different kind of gym. It's a gym for your mind.
Exactly.
And they also run workshops, because I know it, people who said, well, I don't really think I'll go there consistently to use the tools, but I really want to learn some skills. So I know that they run workshops that even if you aren't a member, you can still sign up and, you know, pay a small fee to attend a workshop based on a variety of different subjects, from soldering to 3D printing to other tool usage. So
and they pretty much
have that available.
They pretty much all do that. Make It Labs does that. There's a Lowell Makerspace, which they do several courses per month. But most of them do get involved with actual training and educational things like that.
Right.
Well, great. That's a great discussion on Makers and the Mini Maker Faire and Makers in the area. I'd like to thank Jane for joining us. Thank you, Jane.
Thank you.
So thank you, Jane, for joining us. Remember, listeners, the Mini Maker Faire in Dover is going to be August 27th, a Saturday, from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Jane, is there a cover charge?
There is a charge, but right now we have early bird tickets for $8 per person, and children ages under age 6 are free. And also anyone who volunteers at the fair for 3 hours receives a free T-shirt, free admission to the fair, and free entry into a fun maker party, a load-in party that we have on Friday evening before the fair. We need about 100 volunteers, so I encourage people to sign up to volunteer.
Great.
Yep.
All right. Thanks, Jane. So for our second topic today, we're going to talk about card skimming. I know we're all familiar with the credit card fraud we've seen in the news with data breaches at Target, at Home Depot, at TJ Maxx. And this year, we've also heard about a different kind of breach where the POS terminals, the point-of-sale terminals at Wendy's restaurants, have had malware attached into the POS systems and fraudsters have been able to get the credit card information that way. Today, we're going to talk about something a little bit different called card skimming. We've got a special guest with us today to talk about card skimming. His name is Neeraj Gupta. He works at Vantiv in Lowell, and Vantiv is a credit card processor. Welcome, Neeraj. How are you doing tonight?
Very well. Thank you, Ed. Happy to be part of the show.
Oh, great to have you here. Could you just introduce yourself, please?
Yeah, absolutely. So my name is Neeraj Gupta. I'm a product manager at Vantiv out in Lowell, as Ed described. And I'm responsible now for some of our international efforts, but for the first 2 years of my time at Vantiv, I was responsible for the products and services that we serve to our merchant customers to help prevent credit card fraud or payment fraud. So very apropos.
Right. So this fits in right with that, with your experience with
Absolutely.
Fraud. So can you tell us a little bit about card skimming and what it is, and so that people who might not be familiar with it, what they should be looking out for, or why they should be concerned?
Yeah, absolutely. So you know, and everything you just described, from a breach, really just stealing data from a computer system, or malware put onto a POS device, you know, that little mini device that you swipe your cards in, and card skimming. You know, all of these are ways to illegally access your payment card information. You know, well-intentioned customers that have payment cards, and it's a way to legally procure those in the interest of perpetrating fraud. Now, whether it's in years ago in the form of pickpockets, just stealing cash or cards right out of somebody's off somebody's person, or a breach. These processes evolve, and there's a lot of different ways that these fraudsters attack. Card skimming, in particular, is typically refers to installing some sort of physical mini little device onto a payment terminal. Now that might be a gas station kiosk. It might be an ATM machine, or it might even be right in the terminal at there was a report within the last year of some of those express lanes at Walmart or any retailer. 10 lines, you can kind of self check out 10 items or less. Well, there were reports of those as well. And what you do is you put your card into the device, you scan it. You just think it's just like normal. What you don't realize is there's a little device there that's sitting between your card and the actual proper payment terminal, and it's scanning that information off that magnetic stripe off the back of your card.
And that's the skimming, right? That's
exactly.
Why I call them skimmers.
That's exactly what it is. Those are the skimmers, that's why it's called that.
So I before I came over to the studio today, I just stopped by Lowe's and used one of those self-service checkout kind of things and terminals. So that's very relevant to what I just did. Now, the card I used actually after I swiped it, because there's still, an inconsistent user experience whether you swipe or if you have a chip card, you put it in as far as the chip goes. But it did require me to put the card in and use the chip functionality. Is that, can you talk about how that would be more secure?
Yeah, absolutely. Traditionally, card skimming is done by accessing the magnetic stripe, right? And that's exactly what chip cards are an alternative to. So I'm going to preface this by saying that fraudsters, hackers, the bad guys, they're very good at continuing to up the ante and overcome whatever hurdles we put out there. So, nothing is ever going to be foolproof. But chip cards have been found to be very difficult to skim. I think there were some what's called shimming devices, a little wordplay there, found in Mexico on a POS device that actually accessed the chip. But by and large, chip cards are nearly impossible, at least right now, to be skimmed.
Well, I think from what I understand of them, they use sort of an encryption kind of thing. They do a talk listen sort of thing, an answer request response, I believe, as compared to just a magnetic stripe that sort of has the NRZ, data encoded in a plain text almost kind of format.
Yeah, exactly. And one of the things is when it's a chip, it's more difficult to read. There's all the encryption that's built into it for exactly that kind of purpose. But also, there's less access to those magnetic stripes for backwards compatibility. Just so everybody doesn't have to make a changeover all of a sudden. These cards still preserve. The banks still put those magnetic stripes on there. But typically, when you dip that card, as it's called, dip a chip, that terminal is not going to be able to see the whole stripe, right? And so that also helps you avoid some of those skimming attacks that may still rely on that magnetic stripe.
Right, and with the chip card, there's a token that's sent from that chip out to the processors. And if the processors don't like that token, they're not going to acknowledge or they're not going to approve whatever that transaction is.
Right, right.
And whereas with a magnetic stripe, that's read-only information. So in the past, people have been able to take that information, create their own fake card with a real credit card information on it, and use it as if it were a valid credit card.
Exactly. They refer to white plastic, and that's however those cards are stole. Ultimately, they end up as very often they end up as just reams of numbers on the web somewhere. And there are fraudsters that are very good at just imprinting those onto vanilla Visa gift card. And I forgot my. I guess the magnetic strip got scratched. Can you just key in the number? And that's how they sort of monetize those stolen cards.
Yeah. Well, I remember going to the post office some years back when they started asking to look at the credit card after you swiped it, when you bought something, when you paid for your postage. And at first I was like kind of upset that we had to go through this extra step. And it wasn't until sometime later that somebody told me, no, they're checking to make sure that the number on the magnetic stripe and the number printed on the card are the same.
Yeah.
So it never occurred to me that simple action was an anti-fraud measure.
No, absolutely. It's a great point. You know, fraudsters they're very good at, you know, they're lazy like anybody else, and they want to find the path of least resistance, right? Yeah. So simple measures can deter fraudsters. They say, all right, well, I'm going to find a more vulnerable mark, right? And so even little things like that can be very powerful.
Yeah, way back we used to get our cards checked there, Ed, if you remember, to validate the signature and make sure that the signature actually matched, right? But human nature and the ease of using it, and I want to buy something very, 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 very quickly, so forget all the security steps.
Right.
It gets bypassed. As a security professional, I that's the constant battle, right, is the human factor. It easy. Now, I spent over two consecutive decades overseas, so I'm used to my card having a chip on it. I was appalled when I came back home after two decades and found that we still didn't have the chips on them, but now I've got at least one card with it on it, so I'm happy. So, Neeraj, for my debit card, I've got, and for our audience, I've got this mag strip. So I go to Market Basket, our local supermarket, and I swipe my card and I enter my PIN. If I use a chip card, and they don't have the readers yet, but when they get them, I will insert that, or I think you said dip. I like that. So I dip my card in there, leave it sit, and don't rip it back out. And then, do I still enter my PIN code for my debit card?
You know, that actually depends on the merchant themselves.
Okay, I thought that because I saw a dust up with Walmart, I believe it was, where they didn't want to have their customers actually have to do that. And
yeah, exactly.
I found that interesting because, I mean, as a security professional, that's a step we can use to avoid fraud, and I kind of like that. And everybody knew the PIN already, so it's not a big deal. And it's a step that keeps the fraudsters from using it. I know I've been in my numerous travels, I got caught somebody at Chicago's O'Hare Airport there at one of the diners one morning. My card got hit. I got breakfast, and the card was charged because I got an SMS. I knew my card was charged for $45 more than I spent at breakfast. And so I went and got a police officer and went back to the little restaurant, and they had photos on their phone of the front and back of my credit card. So the waiter went behind the counter with my card and did the camera. And I, since then, I watch. And I actually caught a waiter in our wonderful state here, down south of Manchester, doing the same thing, taking a picture with their private phone of the front and back of my credit card. I thought that was kind of cheeky. Yeah. They were busted, and it appears they were selling to Russian carders of course, it's a valid pair. It's a valid front and back that's a good card. And I was told that they won't use that for like a year because it's good. So they'll just let it sit so they can try to obfuscate where they got the card pair for them and make it more difficult for investigators, which is just evil.
Well, that's so that the owner of the card isn't so, you know, alert to the possibility of the card being misused.
Can't trace it back.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, that, you know, it's interesting too. The attack vector there is, you know, once again, it's a human side of it. It's not necessarily that there's a piece of equipment that somebody's landed somewhere and is skimming. It's a human that's skimming,
right,
a sense. And it's sort of funny because with kids, you know, one of our least favorite things in restaurants now are the little tabletop kiosk-y things, you know?
So oh, yeah. No,
kids
we don't
just want to watch and play the games all the time, right? You know, you just set it out of the way. But, I mean, that does give you, on a certain level, other than a physical, you know, skimmer of some sort, it does give you more control over the security of your card and access to its information.
Right, right. I know some restaurants give you the POS terminal, the point of sale terminal. It may be like a little tablet. It may be some type of specialized terminal. I've seen them sometimes in Europe, they order from the table. It goes over something in the ceiling. It's all wireless. And it goes, and you pay that way as well. I like that because
the waiter never has my, or the server, or whoever, whether it's a clerk, whatever, they never have, that third party never has my card. They don't physically need it. And honestly, with those, I don't think they want it. They just come by and they dump the terminal at your table.
Right.
And they come back by and they look at it. Yep, he paid. Okay, good. Thank you. Have a nice day. And I like that. Mm-hmm. It's easy. And I don't understand why. I'm sure there's an additional cost associated with that.
Yeah, an infrastructure but probably,
The security professional, like me and peers of mine, they will tell you that the human is often the problem.
Right.
And convincing the human that they need to do something mm-hmm. is
a challenge. What about something like a Square? You know, the Square product that you can plug into your iPhone or your iPad and scan like that. I'm not familiar with any...
That's interesting because they have to use the chip PIN, right? So at some time there's going to be a deadline.
I'm not sure on that.
The chips.
No. I think it's a swipe.
But they're going to do away with swipes, right?
It's a good point. But for right now, it's just a swipe across that little square. And I mean, the way it comes in, I believe, is through an audio signal. Yeah, you know, it comes in through the essentially microphone through the headphone jack. As a you know an audio signal, which you can take a if anybody has a cassette tape player, you know anymore a magnetic head out of the cassette tape player and swipe it across to a card and you can hear sort of the sound of the data on that magnetic stripe. And so it's sort of doing it in that way. It's putting it through the microphone input on the iPad or iPhone, and it reads it as, samples, it reads it as data.
Right. Assuming it's an encrypted channel, that should be fine.
So, Niraj, have you heard anything about these squares being skimmed or have skimmers put in them or on them?
Yeah, I haven't run into those as much. I mean, and this is just intuition talking, but a lot of times those are sitting, sitting at a smaller operation, versus sort of a self-service type of setup,
right?
And that kind of prevents. I mean, where you see this most common are ATMs, gas stations, and most recently, but not nearly as much number are those self-checkouts at retailers, right? Those express lanes,
right?
I don't think it would be as common there. And another thing that affects that are when we look at the economics behind the chip cards, and that was something that Visa and MasterCard really had to push. And what they did is they said, all right, you can just, as a merchant, continue to stripe use the magnetic stripe, but you're now liable if you're the weak link in the chain.
Right.
Now, that deadline for most retailers was October last year. Gas stations and ATMs, though, were pushed out. I think with the exception of MasterCard ATMs, that deadline was pushed out to 2017.
Wow.
Yeah, it's funny how some of those forces work. And so those still very well, very well be ripe for that. So anyway, a bit of a digression there, but I haven't really heard anything about Square in particular.
I think Square might. So this is Anton again. I understand that the latest card skimmers are thin, like so thin they're like my FastPass ID sleeve, like a credit card sleeve. I have one of those copper sleeves. So the new readers, at least that are in Europe right now, they're showing up in Germany and I believe in New York here, are the size of one of those sleeves and they're taped. And so they slide this thing inside with a card, with a long card in it. They just shove it right inside the machine and then wiggle it up and down so it sticks.
Get it to here.
And then they've got this thing and it has slots in it, like there's openings in the side. So the regular machine will work or whatever. But these things are no thicker than a credit card. And I thought, well, that's a lot different than a bolt-on to a gas station pump. And that's going to be really hard to see.
Yeah, or if you have to gain physical access inside, some of those where it's, putting more and more of those tamper seal kind of
things. Right. Those?
Well, that leads me to a good question for the group, which is, if somebody walks up to one of these point of sale terminals, is there a way to detect if they've been tampered with?
Well, I think
$1 million question.
Yeah, if it's these thin ones that I just mentioned, it'd have to be pretty sensitive to detect that that's not a real card. It's maybe a little bit thinner. I think that would be really difficult. I think the answer would be if the chip pin combo is defeating that,
mm-hmm.
then that would be yeah. the step. But of course, as Niraj said, they're going to come up with something that will defeat that. So we just need to once the chip pin gets implemented, we need to be looking towards the next step. You know, what's right. the future? Do we add a biometric piece to that? Biometric right now is relatively easy to fake. I've actually disabled and fried the biometric readers on my mobile device I have in my hand right now, my Android phone, and I also disabled the NFC antenna that's underneath the label on your battery. So if you pull out your Android phone battery, you'll see there's an antenna on it. Actually, I think my wife's iPhone had one too.
For like the wireless pay stuff.
Right, right. So I just, I see it as an attack vector, and mm-hmm. I don't use that stuff. So I use my phone for a lot of things, payments. I'm not mm-hmm. totally paranoid, but just a little. And so I ripped the label off it and just pulled that NFC yeah. antenna. It's a comprehensive antenna that runs the whole length of the battery.
Mm-hmm.
And I disabled that, yeah. I only noticed because of the manufacturer. There was an additional note on the battery, and I recognized an antenna, a high-quality antenna manufacturer,
oh, wow.
and that threw up a warning sign. And I looked, and sure enough, I could
there it is.
Feel it on the battery. Yeah.
Well, you know, we've been talking about card skimming in the context of credit card fraud, but there's no reason this couldn't, these skimmers couldn't lift debit card numbers. So,
oh, absolutely not, yeah.
Or medical information.
Yeah, go ahead, Niraj.
Oh, yeah, no, sorry to talk over what I was just talking over, but and that's actually going to be the most common at ATMs, right? And, you think about that as well. There are, far fewer chargeback rights to the consumer when you're talking about debit cards, right? And you have a lot of those programs that you hear about on these commercials about fraud protection up to $50 or no liability. Not so much the case with debit cards. I mean, it's a lot harder when that money comes right out of your account.
Yeah, my understanding is that if your debit card information gets compromised, the banks don't have to protect you at all. They don't have to, reimburse you for any money lost if somebody withdraws money out of your account.
Yeah, it's much less protective. I personally tend to credit cards most of all. Partially that reason.
So, Niraj, do the difference between a debit card and a credit card, so I've got two accounts. I have a business account and a private account at Bank of America. And one of them has, my business account has a chip, and I'm assuming my new private one will have a chip. But they're both debit cards. So they're debit cards with a chip, but they're credit cards when a merchant doesn't accept debit. Like some merchants only take credit.
Right.
So I have to sign when I'm at the terminal as opposed to punching in my PIN, even if I'm using a debit card. So what's the difference there?
Yeah, it's...
Is it how it's run? Is it how the merchant charges my card?
Yeah, exactly, right. So you can take a debit card, and let's say you go online. You're not entering in a PIN for the most part online. It is sort of, the term is cleared. It's a run over... all of a sudden, it sort of masquerades as a Visa card, the classic, Visa credit card. If it's what's called a signature debit or a pinless debit, a signature debit card, and so to a customer, it really doesn't make as much difference. I would say the biggest difference there is going to be to the merchant. The economics change a bit. And actually, you mentioned the Visa and Walmart lawsuit. So what's happening there is very relevant to that question. Visa is saying, I want to accept PIN and you're not letting me on these chip debit transactions. And part of that is saying this is about fraud, right? I want to prevent fraud. But the other piece of that is when a transaction, one of these payments is routed, so to speak, through one of these debit networks, it's going to be a lot less expensive. Right, so a lot of this there's a cost component at play as well.
Right, so debit is cheaper for the merchant, but what's safer for the consumer, for our listeners? I'm hearing the credit. Is that correct? So if I go to a merchant where Well, I personally normally go debit at small merchants because they're local companies, and I believe that they pay less that way. So if I go to a merchant, should I be using credit? Is it safer for me, even with the chip card?
Yeah, you know, I hesitate to make a blanket statement. I would say that I consider it safer because strictly because of the chargeback rights.
There's different consumer protections. The data or the cards aren't inherently different. Is that correct?
Right.
That's what I was assuming there. That chargeback, what you had talked about.
Yeah, it's the chargeback rights. I'm more comfortable using my credit card for that reason also. And if I'm in a situation where I have to use a debit card, I would rather just walk away from the transaction. Just especially online, for online purchasing, I have no idea where these numbers are flying around. So I feel much better knowing that I've got the added protection of the credit card.
Well, that's a good point too. So what in the experience of you guys who deal with the security side of things, what's the difference between online and in the physical? I mean, I know we're talking about skimmers, which you theoretically or you typically think of some kind of physical device or a human attack vector or something like that. But are there still online attack vectors that are really relevant in this day and age of, you know, a high level sort of encryption other than, you know, somebody breaking into a database and stealing a bulk, you know, amount of credit card numbers? Are there still vulnerabilities in of this data in transit?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and that's really where my wheelhouse was, so to speak. With what I did for Vantive, we are seeing an uptick, and it's sort of the new normal with these breaches, with these high volume, you know, versus these kind of lower yield attacks. You know, these high volume breaches allow for a lot more of that data to be sold out there on the black market. And, you know, we see a lot of, and, you know, the other thing at play here is that the chip cards inherently drive down fraud in store. It's simply harder to use somebody else's card in the store because, you know, if it's a PIN enabled transaction, you have to know what the PIN is, and it's harder to counterfeit that chip. But, you know, there's a million analogies out there. I think of it as a balloon, right? If you squeeze one end of a balloon, the air's got to go somewhere, right? And what we see there is that fraudsters are moving to the online world to perpetrate their attacks. So I think it's absolutely something that's very real for customers and merchants out there online.
Niraj, one of the things I was thinking about, because I concur with you right now, I'm seeing more, I'll call it reputable online vendors that are in places that may not be so reputable, and I'll just leave it at that. But my wife even orders from some. There's a lot more online ordering going on, and so your Amazons and whatnot are trusted, generally speaking. And I was thinking the same thing you are, and how, you know, they're moving that way. So how do you counter that from an industry perspective? And while there's a cost involved, I was thinking that perhaps if you increase the frequency that new cards are offered, then the return would only be valid for the life of the card, which may be 6 months. Maybe everybody gets a card twice a year or three times a year. I understand there's a cost involved with that, but right. The benefit would be that by the time the cardsters get a card and have managed to steal it or duplicate it or whatever, there's a time involved with that. By the time they get that, you know, the card's no good anymore. It's been replaced.
It's like asking people to change their passwords quarterly, you know. I mean,
that's the thing. You've got to keep, and I'm a security guy, right? But you've got to fix the frequency. It can't be too frequent.
Right?
It's detrimental. These people that change passwords quarterly, when companies do that, it's my view that that's totally wrong. The best thing is to change them with less frequency. They still have to be changed. But
increase.
Some of them do it every month, and it's just ridiculous because you have to remember that. And if you're somebody like me, you're remembering 20 or 30 passwords, and some of the passwords have, you know, 30, 40 characters in them, and so it gets rather involved. And of course, we don't want anybody to write down their passwords, right? So don't write them out.
Oh, nobody.
Don't put them in that password vault that was, you know, coded in some offshore place where the hackers are. There's all these. So I envision something similar with the cards, where perhaps twice a year they're issued. Now, I don't know what kind of cost would be incurred, but right now my card gets replaced at least three times a year because of some vendor's breach anyway. So
it's a de facto replacement cycle, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, is that a valid vector, a method that we can use to drive down and increase the complexity for the thieves?
It's, you know, it's a good question. To tell you the truth, that's not something that I've come across before, that method. I certainly see the logic, right? I mean, you're reducing the applicable window. What we've seen to be the most common, really, the way I think about it, it's on a spectrum of most intrusive to least intrusive, right? Your trade-off, of course, is you know, those people that click through and hit submit, right? So one of the methods that online merchants use is what's called 3D secure checking, or 3DS, and it's Visa. It's a protocol, and Visa, MasterCard, Amex, Discover, they've all implemented some form of it. It's effectively, you know, this, I'm going to potentially offend anybody who's closer to this, but it's effectively like having to put your PIN in. It's like a dynamic PIN in, or a PIN in when you're online, right? You get a redirected to Visa's page or Discover's page or Amex's page, and you have to put in a PIN that only you know. It's okay. Introducing two-factor authentication.
Right? I'm familiar with that, and I hate it because I have such security in my browser, it breaks my transaction.
Oh, so, absolutely. So you're not the only one.
Hideous. It's worse than Brussels sprouts.
I thought you were going to like two forms verification.
I like when it texts me a PIN on my phone, and I enter the PIN on the phone. That I like a lot more.
Yeah.
And you're not the only one, you know, and this is I actually don't advise, when I've talked to merchants, my personal opinion is I don't advise them to do that because, you know, it's all about consumer behavior. And in the United States, people are used to that 3DS overseas. You know, in the United States, we like our, you know, signature, you know, max grip and signature. We like our, you know, no 3DS.
One,
we like our
purchase.
Imperial.
Yeah.
Exactly.
There's arguably a lot more fraud percentage-wise in the U.S. than overseas, though. At least what I saw as somebody that actually lived there. I never had an issue overseas for 21 years.
U.S. is the biggest market. You know, they're all attacking here. And so a lot of what happens is these people abandon. You know, just like I think it was Ed who was saying that if you had to use a debit card, he would move on. Shoppers do that online too. They say, well, I don't know. It's in an envelope sitting in my recycle bin somewhere. I don't know what that PIN is.
Yeah.
So that's kind of on the most intrusive side. It does work. And then the least intrusive, what we find is, and this is where I have more personal experience, there's a lot more less sort of more behind the scenes analytics taking place. To use data to figure out what are the anomalies. You know, it doesn't make sense that I see the same card being used five times in an hour from three different countries.
You haven't
traveled with me.
Okay. Well,
yeah, I see that. And that's also like the computer, right?
Right. Yeah. Unfortunately, we're running out of time. So I guess we're going to have to leave it here. I've really enjoyed this discussion, though. I think it's been a great discussion on the topic of credit card fraud and security and card skimming. So Niraj, I want to say thank you for joining us tonight. Maybe sometime we can have you back to talk more about fraud in particular.
Absolutely. Thank you guys so much for having me on. I appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah, and thanks for joining us.
Very welcome.